We have three total. We have three total minutes.
Yeah. Okay. I'll just give it to him.
Please welcome Dr. David Chen and Mr. Steven Kowalski. Opportunity to, if you had anything to say.
Yeah, a lot of them were here last night for our world premiere, but firstly, was anyone here like in the credits just now by any chance? Oh, I see some hands, very cool. But basically, you know, the biggest people who helped make this possible are Adam Zaks, who helps run Seattle Theater Group, Jeff Hansen from KUOW, and the people from Cut.com who helped shoot the film. So all those people are Seattle-based, and they helped make this possible. And of course, all the people who contributed to our Kickstarter and the Seattle International Film Festival for bringing us here. So, yeah.
And I think what's really great is that it was filmed at the Moore Theater, which is where the Seattle International Film Festival began. And now you're back at the Seattle International Festival.
Full circle right now.
It's like a Steven Tobolowsky story.
This is...
Steven, that brings me to my next question. So I really liked your take on what storytelling is and why we tell stories and the idea of surprise and how that really defines what a story is. How does that relate to your own life? Your own career is such a surprise when you look at what you're doing now. You know, you're in a concert film, basically, and if you look back 25 years ago, you're a character actor. Do you have any reflections on that?
Everything you said is pretty true. Mm-hmm. It is that my career and my life has moved forward in surprises. I'm about to go to Scotland, and we're going to do some of the stories at the Fringe Festival in Edinburgh. And one of the reporters asked me if you could go back in time and give the young Steven Tobolowsky some advice. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give him? And I thought about it, and the one piece of advice I would have given me is...
Do not take that offer for Atlas Shrugged 3, perhaps? No, I kid. I made a joke, I said, do not take the offer to star in Atlas Shrugged 3, which he was in.
It's okay.
It's
the piece of advice.
Is that the movie where you play the butt crack plumber?
No. That was You May Not Kiss the Bride, in which I had a bedroom scene with Kathy Bates.
Oh, nice.
And we got in bed and the director, Rob, he says, so you guys, how do you want to do this? And Kathy looked at me and says, Toba, shall we do it the way it's really done? And I said, sure. I said, give me the TV changer. She says, give me a bowl of Doritos. And... the producer left the room.
So, piece of advice for your younger self.
My advice for my younger self was, don't be so afraid. I was afraid over everything when I was young. I was afraid I was making wrong career moves. I was afraid I was making wrong decisions, or that the decisions I made were leading in the wrong pathways. In other words, fear is something that destroys the ability to be surprised. Mm-hmm. It overwhelms the ability for you to actually listen to the world and be surprised. So I think early in my life, I lost some of that surprise just from my own anxiety. So that would be my advice to my younger self. If my younger self is sitting out here, don't be so afraid. It's quite a world, and just be surprised.
Speaking of sitting out there, what is it like to sit in the audience and watch your show? Because, you know, I'm on stage a lot too. I have no idea what it's like to sit there and watch a live show and watch the audience reacting with it. And obviously, you've probably done that with movies before, but how is it different watching, you know, what is essentially a Bill and Man show?
Well, it's different because when you watch a movie, usually when you're, there's a difference between doing theater and doing film as an actor, because when you do film, you are really not in control of your performance. You have editors, you have all sorts of things that change up what you do. When you do theater, you are on stage and you are in control of the timing of your character and everything. So you have ownership of it. When you do a film of a one-man show, you have both. So you have, I am looking at me and for that night, because we didn't have a lot of money. We had one shot at it. Usually, when they do these one-man shows, like stand-up shows and all sorts of things, the performer gets, what, several runs?
Several runs, yeah.
Several performances with several audiences, and the performer is always wearing the same clothes, and then they just cut the best scenes together as if it's one show. This was one show. That's all we had. That's all the money we had. So,
have you rehearsed the show like in smaller performances, or this was it? You just stepped off the cliff?
I stepped off the cliff. The way I rehearse, and my wife will verify this, is that all I do is I would walk for miles talking to myself and doing the show to myself, just going like, and then Mom would say, Ben Franklin? And you do that. I got the strangest, people come up to me all the time, and they go like, oh, you're Ned Ryerson. Or they say, one of the great ones was in New York. They said, oh, you're Stephen Tobolowsky. You're the guy who tells the stories. When I was at the supermarket, someone came up during this period of time and goes, I know you. You're the crazy guy who walks in our neighborhood talking to himself all the time. So for months, I was walking through the neighborhoods, running through these stories together, thinking which stories go where and how does it connect or how would this connect. And that's how it evolved. And we never really, the day before, we had kind of a run through for the cameras and to see what position we were in. And that was it. It was like jumping off a cliff, but it was ownership plus the fact now of seeing what David did with the film and the editing, which I thought he did a masterful job.
I want to talk about that a little bit, David. So you only had one shoot to do all this. You obviously used both cameras. How did you, in the editing process, who did you work with, and how did you decide like what moments to sort of, where do you go to close up and where do you go to long shot? And are there emotional moments that you choose to make those edits?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's, you know, this is my first film, and so it's obviously not a narrative feature. It's not even a conventional documentary where, like, there's B-roll and you intercut between conversations and so on. So the decisions were, like, overall fairly simple. And there was actually, like, a surprising amount of just, like, technical things to overcome. So, for instance, some shots, like, I want to go in on a close-up, but because, like, the camera was shaky for that moment, we'd have to, like, cut to the audience, for instance, or something like that. And so, first you, like, trim it to the point where, like, technically it looks really, you know, as good as possible. Mm-hmm. And then after that point, then you can start sort of, you know, choosing the right angles that you feel like would accentuate some of the better parts of the performance.
Were you nervous going into this process, being your first film, or was there sort of a comfort in working with somebody like Stephen, who you've been working with for years and sort of, you know?
You talk as though that makes it like an easier thing.
No,
it is. It was exceptionally nerve-wracking, and this definitely took like a good 5 to 10 years off my life. It's incredibly. I mean, like the way. Fortunately, I worked with some very skilled camera operators and editors, but I like taught myself. I went to lynda.com. If you guys know that site, lynda.com, and I taught myself like how to edit so that when we were doing this film, I could just like, if I needed to demonstrate something, I could just like hand edit it myself and show them like, this is how I want it to be and so on. It was extremely difficult because our production company, the producer, like myself and someone else involved in the production, we all have strong opinions about like how things should look and how the movie should feel. And so ultimately what results is like, you know, the result of three voices kind of like mashing together and resolving themselves. So,
Stephen, can you talk a little bit about how David sort of came into your life?
I guess again, it's one of those stories, is where you start at the beginning. David was interested in the movie Stephen Tobolowsky's Birthday Party.
Right.
Because he liked that storytelling film. And he got a hold of me through Robert Brinkman, who directed that film. And David asked me if I would come on /film.com.
So I had a film podcast called the Slash Filmcast, yeah. And Stephen was on the show, and I loved his stories. They were, like, incredibly profound and funny, and he was just, like, rattling them off, you know? Like, it wasn't even like he was throwing them off like nothing. And I was like, oh, my gosh, like, these are so amazing. Like, what if you actually, like, prepared them, you know, did something, like, you know, what if you put some work into it? Yeah, what if you tried? You know what I mean? What if you tried? And so he was on the show a few more times, and then the last time he was on in, like, about 6 years ago, I pitched him the idea of, like, hey, your stories are so amazing. I want to preserve them somehow. Yeah. Let me know if you want to join me in preserving them. And then soon afterwards,
at
the Tobolowsky Files.
I had a broken neck at that point.
He had nothing better to do at the time.
I had nothing better to do. Except I had time on my hands. And so I said to Ann, this guy, David Chen, he wants to do some sort of podcast of my stories. What do you think? And Ann said, always say yes. Good things happen when you say yes. So I said, David, yes. And I want to bring this up, too, because this is one of the skills David had, besides being incredibly energetic in trying to reach out and doing so many different things. The fourth episode of the podcast was the one where my mother passed away, The Alchemist. And David was pretty much running a film podcast where we would talk about film and movie stories all the time. So I called David up beforehand and I said, I've written this story and it means a lot to me, but it has nothing to do with show business. And David said, do whatever you do, just do it. And so we recorded that, and that completely changed the character of the podcast. Mm-hmm. From that point on, anything was game, like stories like this, yeah, that didn't really have to do much with show business.
And that's sort of what made it stand out and made it distinctive and sort of started to build a fan base, is that just being yourself and telling real stories.
Well, that story about my mother, you know, I still get emails about that from all over the world. And when you share something that means something to you instead of sharing things that don't mean something to you, I think it draws people's attention. And they say this person's stepping, is making this investment, let me make that investment, mm-hmm, too.
The thing I really liked about the stories you were telling in the film specifically, too, is that I feel like that your stories are very personal, they're also very universal. We all have these sort of same journeys where, you know, there are those moments out of time from our life that we think about, and that's sort of what defines us as a person. And I was relating very strongly to some stories you were talking about that had nothing to do with me. That I, like your father being blind and falling all the time. And I was just like, I kind of felt that heartbreak, even though nothing like that has happened to me, but I've had similar, you know, experiences.
Yeah, I think, again, the people from Scotland said, what do you think is the most important element of a story? And something I say in here is that the story is true.
Yeah.
As true as you can make it, the more true you can make the story, the more chance you have of having the story be universal.
Right. Not just factually correct.
Not factually correct, but true. There's a difference. That's what I'll say.
And how does that relate to your work as an actor? I mean, looking back as your career as an actor, have you thought, like, oh, that's kind of how my style has been the whole time?
No.
Or is it something you had to learn? Or?
Yeah, the style has evolved. You know, I began doing kind of pretty much broad comedy, mm-hmm, and then over time you do less and less and less and less. There was a lesson in Aristotle that really made an impression on me, and I've seen over the years that it is true. And that is, Aristotle said that there is this thing in the human brain called technia, which we get the word technique from. And it had various meanings in ancient Greece. In ancient Greece, it meant you were capable of standing up and speaking in front of people. You had technique. But the other meaning of technia is, Aristotle said that the human brain recognizes when something is true. And when it's true, a connection is made in the brain, and there is a release of pleasure in the brain. And I began to notice in comedy and in doing improvisation, I didn't have to tell jokes. If I just said something that was true, like right now, like on the Goldbergs, or Big Time in Hollywood, Florida, in those shows when they ask you to improvise, you don't try to tell jokes. If you just say something that's true in the moment, technia happens, and you realize it works. So the development in my life as an actor is trusting technia more and more and more. The more you can be truthful and less clever, but more truthful, the more success you'll have in being universal and having a performance that means something.
Okay, I want to make sure we have time for some questions from the audience. So we're going to do 4 questions. So, yes.
I spend a lot of time with writers. I'm an editor. I spend a lot of time with writers. And so I encounter a lot of storytellers. And I find myself listening to you and thinking, wow, you know your craft. You're so good at it. And I'm wondering, who are your favorite storytellers? Who do you learn from?
Oh, good question. Who are your favorite storytellers?
Yeah. Favorite storytellers, probably number one would be Charles Dickens. And probably George Eliot is right up there, too. You don't get better than that. One of my favorite storytellers is Maxim Gorky. He, in his trilogy of My Childhood, My Apprenticeship, and My Universities, he tells true stories from his life, and he also doesn't go in chronological order. And it creates an enormous amount of suspense. So I learned a lot of that from Gorky and how he was able to make that work.
Any performers?
It's hard to say because I don't see a lot of like film storytelling. I'm obviously going to a lot of storytelling shows and see a lot of storytellers. And the things I like most in the storytellers that I see is when they don't talk down to the audience. They assume that we have half a brain. And also they keep it moving. They move it along and they don't dwell. So those are two elements.
I was asking about performance because your style and the way you connect the dots and the way you take what could be just an anecdote and turn it into something really deep reminds me a lot of Spalding Gray, who's one of my favorite performers, and I feel like you have that same sensibility.
Right.
And that's rare.
Yeah.
Sorry, we're not kissing but too much.
No. I appreciate it. Spalding Gray was in True Stories that I worked on, and that was the one time I really got to see him and kind of meet him.
Yeah. Yes, in the front.
So, on that note, you always find this epiphany, this moral in the stories that you tell on your podcast. My question is, do you know what you're going for when you start constructing the story? Or does the act of remembering it and writing it down bring you to the epiphany?
That's a phenomenal question.
Yeah, let's repeat. The question was, like, when you're writing the story, there's usually, like, some epiphany moment. So do you start with the epiphany and, like, work from there? Or do you build, like, you write the story and then the epiphany comes from it?
It's three different answers. One is sometimes you know what the point is going to be to the story. Like when I started this, I knew the point of the story was that the primary instinct was transcendence. I knew that that's what I was going for, so I was going toward that. Sometimes you don't know what the epiphany is, but you know that there's a compelling story you must tell. And in telling the story and remembering the events, you find, oh my gosh, that's why that story means so much to me, and you have an epiphany while you remember. And then there's the third one, which is the strangest one. And that is when you start with an epiphany, and it inspires you to tell this story to reach that epiphany. And then when you get to the epiphany, you realize you were wrong. And that wasn't the epiphany, and you just started. And now you're in the desert, wandering, looking for the promised land. And sometimes you find it, and sometimes you don't. But you have to discard it if it's wrong.
Is that how this show happened? Because the story you're telling at the beginning about the little girl asking, or the little boy asking that question, and you realizing that your answer was
yeah,
not what you thought it was. Yeah.
Well, I.